This season of My First Dungeon is sponsored by MythWorks. MythWorks is dedicated to sharing stories we can all enjoy with creators from around the world. They're the publishers of Slug Blaster, The Last Caravan, and of course, The Wild Sea. We are thrilled to be working with a company that makes such great games and that is so dedicated to uplifting creators and the actual play community. So head on over to myth.works and use the promo code MYFIRSTDUNGEON, all one word, for 25% off your order of The Wild Sea, so that you too can set sail upon the verdant waves. Once again, that's 25% off The Wild Sea when you go to myth.works and use the promo code MYFIRSTDUNGEON. And with that, enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast that helps game masters learn new games and make each one better than last. This season, we are setting sail on the rustling waves as we dive headfirst into the Wild Sea. This season is going to be very fun. However, I am not going to be the game master this season. Instead, we'll be turning that game master mantle over to Elliot Davis. Elliot, welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
How's it going? You ready to be the game master, or rather, for this game, the Firefly?
I am. Well, I will be. I'm not yet, but I will be. Yeah.
So, Elliot, when we were talking about this season, I feel like we both saw The Wild Sea and were like, we have to play this. Like, just cover and vibes alone, we were like, oh, this must be on the show. And then digging more into the game, we were like, oh, yeah, absolutely confirmed. What is it about this game that made you excited to play it and want to run it on the show?
So first, like you said, I mean, the vibes alone were enough to grab me and get me interested in this book. And kind of first came across my radar when we were at Gen Con last year, and we actually had the pleasure of meeting Felix and chatting a bit with him. But then when I actually got to dig into the game and read some of the mechanical goodies in here, I got really excited about running it, especially things like the whispers and the ships. And there's so much juicy stuff that I really want to run and like I feel like appeals to my sentiments as a GM.
Also, cactus people.
Cactus people. Cactus people. Yeah.
Hell yeah. I'm really excited for this game. I'm excited to be a player in this season. You know, I rarely get to do that, but more and more I am getting to do it, which is always a dream. But to start us off, Elliot, what are you most nervous about going into this game that hopefully the game designer Felix, who will be introducing in a moment, can help assuage those fears?
Honestly, I am worried about trying to do too much in the time we have because there is so much that I like about this game. I'm worried about over prepping because I think it's based on like reading through the game tells you not to over prep, but there's so much delicious stuff that all I want to do, like my instinct is to just like use all of it and over prep the crap out of a session. But I also want to, you know, not do that and let the players guide a lot of the stuff. So over prepping, I'm a little worried about doing just because I'm so in love with the world, but I don't want to like assign what I think the world should be onto everyone. I want it to be collaborative.
Especially when there's a book that is this rich with like lore and mechanics and characters that are so different from like Swords and Sorcery or like sci-fi or high. It's much more singular than a lot of role playing games that you just want to like eat it all up and, you know, spit it all back out and just be like, look at all this great stuff. Anything else that is particularly stuck in your craw that you're
stuck
hoping
in
to talk
my
about?
Craw?
Yeah, what's stuck in your craw, Elliot?
Some specifics mechanically that I want to make sure that like I encourage the use of and also make proper use of are things like whispers, the depth and pressure mechanics of the new Storm and Root expansion, and then just generally making the ship feel alive and like part of the crew. I know that was like a wish for a lot of our players, so making sure that the ship feels like, you know, a living thing that we're all engaging with throughout the story.
Love that. Well, we want to make sure that you are set up for success. And on My First Dungeon, there is no better way to set up a game master for success than by talking to the designer of the game themselves. So introducing now is the designer of The Wild Sea, Felix Isaacs. Felix, welcome to the show.
Hi, that's me. I'm Felix.
Great to see you.
Hey, Felix.
It's fun having you on because
this season and our, just like as a fun bit of context, this season and our Orbital Blues season that we did late last year both came about from the same interaction at the Roenberg and Deckard after party.
Mm-hmm. Like, that was a good after party. I enjoyed that.
Great after party.
Not spilled too many secrets, but brilliant time.
So, you know, if you liked our Orbital Blues season and if you're about to fall in love with our Wild Sea season, you have Roenberg and Deckard to thank at least a little bit.
Truly.
To be fair, we got Roenberg and Deckard to thank for a lot of things. They're a lovely bunch.
Absolutely.
That's true. They're killing it.
And when we met you, you were sporting your any medal for the Wild Sea.
Yes. Yes, I was, true. Because I didn't take it off. From the moment I won it to the moment I left the convention. Apart from about an hour where I gave it to our forklift expert to wear, because he was the number one forklift expert.
Perfect.
I don't get to win medals very often, so, you know.
It's rare that anyone gets to win medals outside of professional athletes. So when you get it, you really want to take advantage of it. It's like after the marathon in New York, you always see a bunch of people the next day wearing their marathon medals. And there's always a part of it that's like, hell yeah, wear that fucking medal.
Yeah. One of the things I enjoy was really, Felix, you're still wearing the medal. Like, it's an Emmy. Come on. It's not. And it's like, no, this is the first medal I've won probably in my life. Like, this is amazing. I love this.
Yeah, I'm taking advantage. You got to swim in the compliments when you get them.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Well, to start us off, Felix, just kind of looking at the Wild Sea from the very initial seed of an ideas, what were the inspirations for this book when it first started?
So in terms of real world stuff, I was living in Japan and I could see both a forest, a mountainside, and the sea from my office building. And so over time, those concepts just kind of came together. But on a more immediate note, the thing that caused them to come together was watching the forest get torn down so the mountainside could be reinforced with concrete, which was not very fun. Mm. And that brought in the whole, like, you know, what if nature won type of thing, which underpins all of the Wild Sea. So it's a much more real life kind of eco reason than some games. But that is what kind of put it into my head in such a strong way. But then there was also the actual game design side of things as well, which was that I'd been isolated from role-playing games for a long time, living and working abroad and not really being part of the online scene at all. And I really wanted something that was, well, back then I didn't know the term fiction first, but something in which the narrative took more of a fore. Because up to that point, I played a lot of Call of Cthulhu and a lot of Pathfinder and a decent amount of 3.5. And that was about it. And then hadn't played anything else for years, really. So I thought I'd try and make a game that suited how I felt now. Having completely missed the PBTA and FIDD booms across the industry, which would have made my early designing a hell of a lot easier.
And then for anyone who hasn't already picked up the Wild Sea or hasn't dug into it yet, can you give us a quick overview? Because I don't think we've actually said it on this podcast yet. What is the Wild Sea?
Okay, So the Wild Sea is a fiction-first narrative game where you play wild sailors. You essentially form a crew and then create a ship to crew and sail that across the kind of titanic expanse of a treetop forest, which acts very much like a sea. Trees have covered the world after some grand ecological disaster in which nature won and will continue to win forever as far as the game is concerned. Which means that you have the opportunity to do things with nature that you wouldn't normally get away with, like have a massive chainsaw ship and know that the path you leave behind you will close up again in a matter of minutes or hours rather than be a massive scar on the landscape forever. So, yeah, it's a game in which you can fight nature and not feel bad about it because nature has won, will win, and will forever win.
I also just got to know, how happy were you on the moment after you thought of the term chainsaw ship?
Oh, extremely happy. And I still see comments. People are like, what's this Wild Sea thing? And people are like, treetop forest, chainsaw ships. Are you happy at chainsaw ships?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm really glad to come up with that.
Sometimes it doesn't take much to just really sell a thing.
And every now and then you also get someone who's like, how would a chainsaw ship actually move through? Wouldn't it just cut its way like downwards? And it's a weird fantasy game. Just if you can accept magic and other things and light speed in sci-fi, you can accept that chainsaw ships can also pull themselves forward as well as downwards. And if it bothers you that much, there's loads of non-chainsaw options too. So
Felix, I was saying to Brian when we were talking about this game that one of the things that I'm liking more and more from role-playing games is when I, as the GM, am not doing a lot of rolling, and that we're putting the rolling on the players as reactions and things to move the story. So in terms of that rolling in this game, I'd love to just get kind of a summary from you of what the core dice pool mechanic looks like in this game for folks who aren't aware.
You have a series of things on your character sheet you can draw dice from, essentially. There's edges, which are your general areas of competency and approaches towards things as well. And they're an easy 1d6 to start up your dice pool. Then skills and languages, if you're using those, are between 1 and 3d6. And you can get advantages from the aspects you have, which are the special things that define your character, and from the environment and any help from teammates. So you end up with a pool, usually between 1d6 and 66 is the maximum. Roll it and look for the highest number as a result. And if that was it, it would be reasonably boring, but luckily that's not, because the results in the Blades in the Dark fashion are split into kind of three bands of success. All bands moving the story forward, but some in worse ways than others. But also, if you roll a double, you have Twist, which moves the kind of GM's authorial side onto the players for a short time. With a twist, something unexpected happens, and that unexpected thing is unexpected even for the GM. So the player, not that rolled it usually, but anyone else at the table can throw out some ideas on what might happen that is a small unexpected thing. And that's your basic dice system, unless you want to include cut as well, which I should include because people forget to use cut.
Well, I do want to ask specifically about cut and impact, because I feel like that's where like my role as the GM comes in, is like when to put in cut and like how to talk about the different levels of impact. So could you take us through both of those?
Okay, I'll do impact first because impact's simpler.
Cool.
They're both pretty simple, but impact's the one people get more easily. Impact comes in a few different levels. There's low, in which you don't really do much to the environment around you. Normal, which is normal. And then high, where you have a great effect on what's whatever you're trying to do, essentially. And it's the kind of the difference between shoulder barging a door and having it budge an inch, or shoulder barging a door and having you barge through a door, and shoulder barge a door and having you kick that door to splinters. That's like low, medium, and high impact. But there's also massive impact, which is usually reserved for things like ship weapons, things that will obliterate whatever it's facing, or have such a great impact that things will be changed irrevocably. And going back to the door example, that is, you don't need to shoulder barge a door, you can just smash through a wall, why not? Like, or if you do shoulder barge a door, you take the entire frame off at the same time. And that's impact. It's a pretty simple system that mechanically interacts with how many times you mark a given track. But the bit that I find more exciting and interesting is cut, which is how the Wildsea handles difficulty. If you have any role should be difficult, dangerous, or dramatic. Like, otherwise, you shouldn't be rolling. You should just do it. But if something is difficult, dangerous, or dramatic to a degree that is more than normal, the GM, Firefly, can start adding cut, which is a system where you remove rolled results. You don't take dice out of the pool. That just means you roll less, and that's less fun. Instead, you get really cruel, and you take away the highest result that someone has rolled if they're cutting. Or if you cut two, take away the two highest results, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And cut is narratively a lot more fun, even though it is crueler than just removing dice in terms of in a kind of brute numbers game. Because you get to see what you lost. Like that six and that five that you rolled, they're gone now. But you know you had that six and five, and you can narrate how close you came and what got in the way. It is an aid towards role-playing in that particular way.
It reminds me of the resistance system.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
RRD, where you're pulling a certain number of results depending on difficulty. That's great.
Yeah. I don't know if I subconsciously stole Cut from the Resistance system, because I did read Heart at some point as I was doing the Wildsea, and Heart is now one of my favorite games. So, but even if I did, I'm glad, because it's a brilliant system.
yeah, there are worse places to steal from.
I have not a bad thing to say about Heart. Or most of its mechanics, but there are a few that don't always sit well with me. But that's fair for every game. There are a few Wild Sea mechanics that don't sit well with me sometimes, and I wrote the thing. So
yeah,
I think the other thing that is important for this game mechanically, and it's something that I, as a game master and as a player, just haven't played with much, mostly because I haven't done much Blades in the Dark type systems, and that is tracks, which is not a thing I've done very much outside of something like Yazeba's, where it's used much differently. So can you talk to me about how tracks are used in this game, and also kind of the size of tracks for various things? Because like in D&D, everyone kind of inherently knows, like, okay, DC 15 means this.
Yeah.
The size of a track is not something I inherently know at this point.
No, that's entirely fair. So tracks are a series of linked boxes or circles. They generally default to circles because they're easier to draw. And as things happen, you mark them. So it could be at the time leading up to something, measured in players' actions. It could be how much someone likes you. And every time you do something for them or affect them positively in some way, you can mark their track. It could be anything, really. Tracks are a wonderful all-purpose tracking system, literally. Mm. And once a track is full, something changes. It could be something for the better, it could be something for the worse, but something always changes when a track is fully marked. As for length, it's mutable. Characters all have their own tracks. The aspects, the things that make them special, have a track between 1 and 5 boxes, and that acts as a kind of damage-absorbing sponge. When an aspect's track is full, they lose that aspect. But if you don't mark an aspect when you take damage, you just take an injury, which is far worse. A 5 is a good kind of, this is the average chunky track to have. A track of 3 is easily filled by 3 discrete actions, or 1 normal effect action and 1 high impact action, or just 1 massive thing might fill a 3 track on its own. So 3 is on the lower end, 5, 6 is the middle-ish, and when you get past 8, you're either having to fill it with really high impact stuff, or lots and lots of actions over a long period of time. So tracking down the big bad of a campaign might be like a 12 track or a 15 track or something. As long as the players know, not even just the characters, as long as the players know, you don't need to fill this in 1 or 2 sessions. Like, this will be a thing you slowly fill over time.
Interesting.
But yeah, track length is really variable because tracks are meant to be filled at different paces. You could literally have a track that is like countdown to the root quake, where the sea is about to shift and everything goes wrong. And every box on that track is, say, the 5 track, every box on that track is a split second decision that someone of the crew gets to make. And it's filled in, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of real world time.
I really love the way that the book, and I was reading part of this book yesterday, and there's a part of it that describes going on a mission, like setting sail, as like you set out from a port, you have a track in front of you, and once this track is filled, you get to your destination. And so there are like different things you can do within that track. You could, you know, forage, you could hunt, you could have montages, which is something we'll get into in a minute. But I really love the structure and kind of the like, it's unstructured structure. It's great. It's like, I know we get to do 10 things. You can do any 10 things during that time. But once you finish this thing, once, you know, you have this amount of stuff to do, then you're going to be at your destination. You have to deal with whatever is there. So, you know, use that time wisely. But everyone is aware from the outside, from a player-facing setting, okay, we have 10 actions, you know, quote-unquote, to do before the next big beat of the story happens. I find that really, it's something I haven't done as a GM or really as a player, and I'm excited to experience it as a player, and I'm also excited to dive into it from a GM perspective sometime in the future, because I think it will be really just helpful in counter design and in campaign prep.
Oh, yeah. It works really well for things that are more fiction forward, and it works well for things where the players get to set a lot of what happens as they, you know, things that are low prep in general. Because it means that generally players aren't hunting for the thing they are meant to do. They are thinking about, what can I do that will fill this track? Which is a very different way of thinking. Because if you think there's only one thing possible, choice paralysis sometimes sets in. Sure. And it's like, well, if we do the wrong thing, we're just kind of wasting time. Whereas with a track system, you've got a few boxes to fill. There's obviously more than one thing you can do. So why not try that weird idea you've had?
Yeah.
It's just, it's a nice way of helping people be a bit more confident in what they can do. There are no real wasted actions. And even if it doesn't fill a track, with the way the world sees rolling works, it will affect the world in some way. Because the worst result is not a failure. The worst result is a disaster. Everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Right. It's still moving forward, just not in the way you would like it to.
Yeah. There is no failure. There is only triumph. Way, this is amazing. Everything's great. Conflict. Oh, this is okay, but it could have been better. And disaster. Oh, God, no, what's happened? Those are the only three options.
Those are great options.
Speaking of this idea of, like, everything still affects the world, I do want to talk about whispers, because I think it's one of those things that, like, I responded to a lot in reading. It just was the kind of thing that, like, I was like, oh my god, like, words have power, and you can, like, alter reality in these different ways, and, like, the different levels of volume having different effects. And it's something that I really want to use in this season. But I guess I kind of want to know if you have any specific advice for, like, introducing whispers, or like when you give them, when you encourage people to use them, how to make sure it's something people are encouraged to use.
Part of it depends on how whispers appear in your game. One of the fundamental principles behind the Wild Sea is that everybody's table is different, and that your Wild Sea might not be like someone else's Wild Sea. I've seen people play the Wild Sea in kind of weird fantasy lands, which is generally what I do. I've seen some people do it as, this world was once Earth. If you go down deep enough, you find tower blocks type things. And that's not how I typically play it myself. It's absolutely fine. And the same works for things like whispers. Whispers are, if you go into the fiction of it, living words. They burrow into your head. They're echoes of situations and fantastic moments, or terrible moments sometimes. And when spoken, they can affect the world. But whether you do that as a kind of out of the fiction of the game thing, if you want to have something that's like, well, a whisper is really just kind of pulling at the kind of skeins of fate slightly. This thing would have happened anyway, but I'm using this whisper to make it happen. Then don't really appear in world. But if you want something that's a lot more tactile, which again is how I tend to play, whispers are physical things. They're living words. They can be caught in bottles. They can be fished out of tree stumps. They can be, you know, pulled out of someone else's head if you try really hard.
Oh, fuck. I didn't think about them as being fucking messages in bottles. That slaps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of my favorite characters that I've seen someone else play, and I think that might have given me the idea in the first place, is someone who was a whisper collector, and they just had the inside of their coat ringed with bottles. So when they used a whisper, instead of like speaking it into the world, they just smashed a bottle on the ground, like a kind of like a whisper alchemist. It was amazing.
Oh, God damn.
Damn that it. Is now so I good. Gotta now I gotta think of other character ideas. I thought I had stuff all lined up, and now I gotta do it all again.
Oh, you can do pretty it's weird fantasy by definition. Like, you can do pretty much anything.
And I think that's what this crew is interested in. Like, when we had a pre-session zero chat where I essentially was like, how much of the weird of this world do you want to lean into? And I talked specifically about whispers, and everybody seems really down for, like, whispers are the physical thing version of whispers, which I'm really excited about.
I'm glad to. That's how I prefer it. But the other thing, actually, if I had to give whisper advice, picking them up, have them as echoes of large events. That's a useful thing. Also, have them traded if they're physical things. They can be traded, just like salvage or specimens or charts.
Right.
But my most important bit of whisper feedback, again, the thing people mostly forget, whispers aren't just for the player characters. I very rarely see kind of NPCs or hazards use whispers, but they've got access to them just like everyone else. They'd be rare if you never left port and you didn't go sailing, but for a group of, like, marauding, actually, I can use a real world example. For a group of marauders that sounds awful now. I'm still going to say it. For a group of marauders who spend their time collecting people's teeth to trade on the black market, they might have a few good tooth based whispers to use. Why not use them?
That's a really good little nugget of advice that they're not just for player characters, and also something I will use.
Oh no.
Yeah. And it's you can actually the same with tracks as well. Like, people often think of like tracks, they're more for just like, they're for more than just counting health and things or counting the time to stuff. If you want a particular hazard, marauders, pinwolves, whatever, to have something waiting in the wings, you can signal that with a track. You can show that kind of anime-esque build up towards their special move.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where tracks, the mutability thing comes into play, because you can have certain things knock boxes or knock marks off that track, as well as other things mark that track.
Right.
So, yeah, don't be afraid to represent or foreshadow what is happening. Even if the players don't know specifically what it is, don't be afraid to have a track out there in the open and say, hey, this is a hidden track. You know it's here. You know what it is. It's not going to be good. Don't let this fill.
Oh, I like that about the hidden track. So not treating hidden tracks as fully hidden, but what they are is hidden, but showing that something is ticking.
Yeah, there's the three levels of track are like open, hidden, and secret. A secret track, no one apart from you as the Firefly knows it's there at all.
Mm.
But a hidden track, people are aware it's there. They might even have the name, but they won't know specifically what it's leading up to. They'll just have that little hint.
Very good.
I feel like a thing that I learned, that I like doing in role-playing games, that I learned initially in D&D, was like telling people what a DC was and letting them roll it so you know what you're looking for. And it somehow is way more impactful when you roll and you're like, oh yes or oh no.
Mm.
Whereas if you just roll and go, is a 15 enough? And then it's just no or yes, it's less exciting. But when you see it in front of you and you can feel that countdown mechanism or that like obvious goal, you immediately know, and you can get actively excited in the moment that the thing happens rather than waiting for someone to confirm your excitement or depression.
Definitely. And I felt like that when I used to play D20 style games as well. Like, that was a thing that I felt quite a few times, especially with one of my DMs, who was a lovely guy, but he kept everything secret. And after a while, it's like, I just want to know. I want to know if this is a tense situation or not.
Yeah.
Because when you say, oh no, I only got a 12, waiting for the bad stuff to happen, they go, oh, no, that's enough.
Right. It helps to frame things when you know, is this a DC 12 or a DC 25? Is this a two-track thing or is this a 12-track thing? It's like...
Right. Sets a different context when you're like, this hidden track has 8 versus this hidden track has 3. It's like, that's automatically giving it weight. Yeah, yeah.
This one I drew butterflies around, and this one has skull and crossbones at the end. Maybe focus on the butterfly one.
Oh, and there's also track breaks as well, where you know you can put a little break in the tracks showing something is going to happen at this point, even if the full track isn't filled, etc., etc. There's a load of really simple but really effective tech you can do with tracks. They're very flexible, but just a series of marked boxes.
Yeah, it seems like, in terms of what I was saying about worrying about over-prepping, it feels like you do a lot of your prep by just creating a handful of tracks.
Oh, yeah. I still fully hold that the Wild Sea is a low to zero prep game.
Mm.
Especially in terms of what you put on paper. Have some ideas and then see how the start of the game goes and let those ideas evolve. Planning, over-planning is kind of the curse for a Firefly, like that you should avoid at all costs.
Mm.
Far worse than underplanning, because if you underplan in the Wild Sea, which I personally don't think is possible, but maybe it is theoretically, if you underplan in the Wild Sea, the mechanics, the fiction first mechanics, twists and things, they will give direction or opportunity, because players will come in and they will give their ideas. If you overplan, you'll get into that situation where you know what you want to come next, but maybe the player's got something else that they want to come next. And in traditional role-playing, like how it was done in the olden days, now I feel old, oh God. But in traditional role-playing, a bad DM would always be, oh, well, my story comes first, that kind of thing doesn't happen. Like that doesn't work. And we've luckily moved past that for the most part.
Yeah.
Not always, and not at every table, but you know, that's life.
No, but it's also not the kind of thing that I want to do with this season. It's just like I can feel my brain already wanting to just like make a bunch of cool stuff out of what I'm excited about in the book, but definitely don't want to get into it like a over-prepared railroading kind of situation.
Yeah, the best campaign at the Wild Sea I've ever run personally. I planned out I think 3 things in advance. I knew what the starting location was in broad strokes, and then I let players fill in a little bit of the details of that when I started, so it was fresh to me as well.
Mm-hmm.
I knew roughly what the end was going to be in terms of what would happen if the player characters didn't intervene. But I kept in mind that there was a chance that they wouldn't intervene. Like, they might get way off track and this thing might happen. And I didn't need to track it, but I could have done. I could have made like a 20 box track leading up to it and just marked one every single session. When the 20th box is marked, it's the end of the world. Hooray, well done. But I tend to avoid tracks for that kind of thing. Doesn't mean you have to, but I tend to. And the third thing I did was like, I really like this creature. I'm going to use this creature. This is the hazard. It's going to turn up somewhere. Might turn up like in the first session, might turn up in the 10th, might turn in at the hold the ship, might turn up leaping out of the sky. I don't care. I like it. I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just pick a few cool things.
The 80s are over, and you're not kids anymore. Now is a much darker time. Something happened to you, and you got touched by the weird, and it made you wild, and it made you powerful. This is the world of The Lost Bay, a suburban gothic RPG. A fever dream set in 1990X and inspired in equal parts by dark fantasy, horror classics, and the 90s indie culture. After years of development, and thanks to the feedback and support of a community of early enthusiasts, The Lost Bay is coming to Kickstarter, featuring a full rulebook and complete setting designed by Eco, kick-ass art by Evangeline Gallagher, killer maps by Strega Wolf Vandenberg, and six additional modules by some of the coolest designers in the indie scene. So go right now to thelostbayrpg.com to back this project. That's thelostbayrpg.com. The Gardens of Yin is now funding on Kickstarter. The Gardens of Yin is a randomized depth crawl adventure set in an ever-shifting, extra-dimensional garden. The deeper you head into the gardens, the more perilous and unusual the locations become, ending in whatever secrets lie in the garden's deepest depths. Each route of your expedition is generated as it's explored, resulting in new vistas being unlocked with every visit. This campaign will remaster Gardens of Yin by Emmy Allen, with new art by Riot Bones and an offset print run by Soul Muppet Publishing. Gardens of Yin is made for old-school systems, but can be easily converted for use in other TTRPGs. To support this project, search Gardens of Yin on Kickstarter. That's Gardens of Yin, spelled Y-N-N, on Kickstarter. Have you ever had a boring boss battle in a role-playing game? Ever struggled your way to the climax of a dungeon only to spend 3 hours taking turns rolling to hit? Ever wished there was a way to have exciting fights where your tactics matter without getting bogged down in minutia and maths? Of course you have. And the good folks at Rowan, Rook & Deckard, creators of Spire, Heart, and many other fine role-playing games, are doing boss battles justice with Hollows. Hollows uses a lock-on combat grid focused around the boss monster instead of the location. So it's always the center of attention, and your position always matters. With rules inspired by Bloodborne and Monster Hunter, and a setting inspired by Silent Hill and Jacob's Ladder, Hollows is a unique new game from award-winning designers Grant Howitt and Christopher Taylor. You can learn more and download the free quick start adventure, The Sins of Grisham Priory, by visiting rrdgames.com/hollows. There is a thing about games, when I see game books like The Wild Sea, which is a thick book, it's a hefty guy, it's a tome.
Oh yeah, 360 something pages.
And that's like, that's big. I mean, that's like, you know, a 5e style Pathfinder. You know, it's a hefty, hefty book. But inside, a lot of it is just vibes. A lot of it is just like, oh, hey, yeah, here's yeah. cool stuff and lore and things to really get your mind going. And a thing that both me and Elliot picked up on that we really like seeing in a book like this is a number of times, like more than I think I've seen in any other book, there are parts where you call out like, hey, if you don't like this, don't do it. Or here's an alternate version if you don't like this. Or, hey, if you don't like this book, take just the name of the Wild Sea and play your own game. It's very laissez-faire about what is important and what isn't. It just gives you all the options, gives you all the tools, and then allows you to choose.
Yeah, it was a kind of fundamental cornerstone of how I tend to design things. If I can say that, having only two books published, and one of them still printing, so you know, what do I know? But it's a fundamental cornerstone of how I try and design things, is that I'm not there at the table. I don't care if this is played the way that makes me happy. What matters is that other people get to play it the way that makes them happy. And the community now is big enough, and I get enough feedback that it's like, these things that I think are fundamental or core, that might not always be true. So I can get ahead of things and add a few variant rules and say like, hey, if this doesn't work for you, you could try this. You can also do anything you like, but like, you could try this and this is Felix approved.
Yeah, I particularly like the alternate character presentations that you give for I think every Bloodline and post, like, here's what this is, but it could also be something like this. And I know that in talking to some of our players, like, that's already turning some things in their heads, which I love to see. And kind of shifting gears a little bit towards character creation, I'm curious how, when we go into session zero, like, how can I best set the players up for success when it comes to character creation in your mind?
Oh, are they creating characters together?
We are on mic, yeah, in session zero.
Oh, the best kind of session zero. Okay, brilliant. I would say, if you want to do a perfect session zero, in my opinion, make the ship first.
Oh,
interesting.
Now, we don't normally get to do that, because normally people make their characters beforehand and then make a ship that suits their characters. And that is absolutely fine. But I would say another way of doing it, which I think it comes up surprisingly rarely, just because of the way that people make characters, but always seems to work really well, is when you make the ship first, you have an environment that you can picture your character in. You can always tweak the ship again later. So you can change things around, but it helps people, especially in a weird fantasy world, to not make their characters in a blank void.
Mm. Right.
You've made this space. You know what the engine room's like. You know what this thing runs on. You know that the engine is powered by beads, right? So then maybe the Chelicrae player is like, well, I was going to make a Chelicrae. I was going to make like a hive mind of spiders, but maybe I can make a hive mind of bees as one of the alternate presentations. Mm. And you've got that sudden connection to the ship. You know what your character does and what their fiction is. It doesn't work for every group. So, but like, that's what I like to do with the few rare occasions I get to do it.
Mm, that does sound very fun.
I like that.
Yeah.
We might have to do this in our session zero. Do that.
Yeah.
It's fun because I already have so many like ideas for characters, but I would like to see what's the ship we're going to be on.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing it avoids is people designing a ship to fit their specific character needs. And that's not a bad thing at all. Like, you should do that in an ideal world. That's great. But if you have a campaign and you know it's going to be a campaign, you know it's going to be multiple sessions, it gives a character something to aim for. You've made your ship, but it doesn't have a workshop. You make a rattle hand. You're an engineer who has no workshop in the space they live. You now have an immediate goal. Gather the things that are going to help you make a workshop on that ship.
Mm-hmm.
So you know there is a thing that no matter what else is going on, you can get little bits of that stuff. You can find scrap and salvage. You can trade for things in port. You can make that, and then you can make the workshop for yourself. You have just made the ship even better, more suited to you through the action of play.
I like that a lot.
Which is lovely. And again, there's nothing wrong with starting and saying, I'm a rattle hand, I'm an engineering type, make sure the ship has the workshop. That's also fine. It means you feel at home from the start, but you develop less.
Right. It is also nice because I feel like a game like this, I think this is also true with like most like seafaring or spacefaring games, is like you want the ship to be part of the crew. You want it to be a character. You want it to be like a living thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Starting with it first, which is something I don't think I've ever really thought. I've always thought like, yeah, you make your characters and you make your ship. But like the idea of starting with the ship first is like, okay, great. Now let's inhabit this home with people who would find a home there rather than build a house for five possibly disparate people.
Like I said, both ways can work, but it's one of the things that I find has surprisingly good results when I get to it.
I'm kind of sold on it. I mean, I'm going to run it by everybody, but I'm kind of sold on it. That's the plan.
And it doesn't mean that players can't go into it with an idea of what they want to play anyway. Like most people do, even if they haven't made their character yet, they'll have some ideas. So they can still have that idea in mind as they make the ship.
That's right. You know.
I do have a question that I'm just curious about, kind of adjacent to character creation, because now like the Wild Sea has a pretty large community. You've gotten feedback and things. And I'm just curious because the Bloodlines, the Posts and the Origins are very different from a lot of role-playing games.
Yeah.
Have you found that there is a certain post or bloodline that more people gravitate towards, or ones that you're surprised more people don't use?
No, Chelagrei. Chelagrei is the fan favorite. Chelagrei is everyone's favorite, apparently. People want to play hive mind of spiders and a weird self-made Sulcan skin. That is what a good 50% of characters I've seen have been just Chelagrei.
Love it.
People love them.
Wild.
Also, I've said that my kind of out of left field one is I made it because I thought it'd be really fun, but I didn't think it would get much use. The word bearer, the post where you are a postman, a Wild Sea postman, you just deliver things to different places. I see a lot of people, I don't see many who are playing it, but when someone does hear about it, every now and then you'll get a, oh, that is the coolest thing. I have the perfect idea for this. And word bearer players tend to get really, really invested in that part of their character, which I'm really happy with. So.
I remember first seeing a like postman character in when we played Wanderhome. And the second I read that, I was like, oh, obviously everyone's going to want to play this. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to play this. And then we get to character creation. And I was like, oh, I can do it. Great. And the same thing with this. I'm like, I saw the char that was the like cook class. And I saw the postman class. And I'm like, oh, clearly everyone's going to want this.
Chars are generally pretty popular in the world team. There's very rarely a game I've seen without a char of some kind or a steep, which is the kind of,
I think the steep is so fun. Yeah, both of those.
Well, I can't take credit for that one. The steep was one of our guest posts from Rick, our head of playtesting, and he knocked out the park with that.
Oh, he's yeah, amazing. It's great.
Love it.
It's great. So moving away from the core Wild Sea, because one of the other things we want to do in this season is make use of this new expansion that you've put out, the Storm and Root expansion. I think all of our players, when we talked about like what they're interested in, we got a lot of like, the Eldritch and the weird and the like unknowable, the Krezerin. And so I think that we're thinking about maybe diving into the depths of the Wild Sea. And so I want to talk a little bit about what Storm and Root is bringing to the game and what some of these new mechanics of like pressure and snaps are.
Well, Storm and Root brings airships and submersibles. I prefer the submersible side, obviously, because it takes you deeper into the sea. Although the airship side is also quite fun in its own way. But the airship side is very much about, like, suddenly you're a lone speck in an empty sky. Whereas the submersible side is, oh my god, there's things everywhere. We're being crushed by the physical and psychic pressure of traveling down into the dense branch network of the Wild Sea, which we had hitherto just sailed on the top of, where it's reasonably safe. Didn't feel safe then, but it feels safe compared to what we're going through now. So, yeah, obviously I like submersibles more. And the pressure system is just the deeper you get, the harder it is for things from the surface of the sea to live. Things go horribly wrong. And snaps are an example of this. They are essentially bad twists. A snap lets you have really negative things happen to get a little relief from the pressure, like a little pressure valve being kind of tipped for a moment. It's basically going deeper in the Wild Sea makes everything worse. There you go, that's my tagline for it. Going deeper in the Wild Sea makes everything worse.
Can I ask, like, from the Firefly's perspective, like, how do you make that a tantalizing endeavor? of like what makes a group of players go, yeah, like let's
make our lives ship worse.
And dive deep and make our lives worse. Yeah,
that's actually a surprisingly easy one. Almost all the cool things to interact with up on the surface have been dredged up through kind of NPC effort or root quakes or environmental movement from the depths in some way. So the deeper you go, the closer you get to the sources of weirdness, the unusual things that would be an oddity that you'd hardly ever find above. When you go deeper, you can start searching them out specifically. Mm. I want to find this kind of thing. Okay, but you're gonna have to dive to get there.
Yeah, that's all in line with what we're interested in, the weird and the cool. Yeah.
I kept saying during our kind of pre-production meeting, I'm excited for a scene of, instead of having a shopping montage, having a building montage where we transform a regular ship into a submersible.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. I always, my advice for all crews is, even if you want to do a campaign with the airship stuff and the submersible stuff, make a normal ship first and then adapt it after a session or two, because you just get that. The feeling of sailing the actual waves in a normal ship, normal, but the world's even, you know, it gives a wonderful grounding point.
Mm.
Submersibles and airships and stuff, they are more advanced ways of play. They bring in more rules. There's more of a mechanical weight to certain things. Oh, and also, along the same lines, advice-wise, don't go too deep too fast. The pressure gets worse the deeper you go. But even with the negative effects of pressure, some crews are tempted to like, okay, we're going to go as deep as we can. And it's like, that's okay. I mean,
you can.
Good luck.
Yeah.
You can.
It just won't be fun at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. There are ways to rob yourself of some fun playing any game. And I guess the thing to watch out from the wilds is, don't just dive really, really, really deep and then go, okay, we've done the one thing we came for, and we're all close to kind of narrative death. Now we'll just go back at the surface, right? And it's like, no, that's a journey, just like getting down here. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay. I guess we'll just stay here.
Actually, kind of on that point, I think we haven't discussed yet is like how damage and how health works in this game, and also how character death works in this game. Can you talk us through both how character death works and how health and you know, taking damage works?
When you take damage, it is done to your character's aspects. They are the usually between 4 and 7 things that make your character truly unique, the things that make you stand out. So a character might have their own particular special sword as an aspect, or a prosthetic arm, or a companion, like a pet of some kind. When you take damage, it gets moved onto your aspects. Each aspect is a track. When that track is full, you lose access to that aspect temporarily. You can always heal it, get it back in some way, because these are the things, these are like Conan's sword. He might be denied that sword for a while, but you know he's always going to get a sword back. That is part of who Conan is. He is a guy with a sword who hits things with a sword. Occasionally an axe, you never know. And that's kind of how aspects work. They're the things that your kind of main character is not without. Or if they are without it, it's temporary, and that's a special state of being. It's, and they're not something you can ever permanently lose.
So we're not killing pets.
No. That's the other thing. Never kill a pet. Never kill a pet. Just in real life, in games, never kill a pet. Pets are brilliant. But yeah, the other thing that kind of dovetails into is character death, which I have seen one of the weirdest takes us in for people saying it. I'll get to my weird take in a second. It's just, it baffles me, so it's the kind of the front of my mind every time. There is no mechanical death in the wild scene. You can mark every single box on every single track you have. You can take mass amounts of injuries. That doesn't kill your character. What kills your character is the narrative choice that is up to the player, that you are now in a situation where the only real, sensible, logical story thing to happen is that you die.
Mm-hmm.
And that means some players, their characters very rarely, if ever, die. And others, they can die in a single session when they still have boxes left to mark on tracks. I've seen both happen. And I've seen people, especially more of the kind of older school crowd, say, you know, but then if you can't die kind of accidentally, if death is a narrative thing, then there's no challenge, there's no danger. And it always confuses me, because like, I live in a flat, I've got a balcony, I could jump off that balcony and I probably wouldn't die. Like, it's not high enough that I'd die. It would be really painful, though. I would definitely break some bones. It would be an extremely dangerous activity. It's not suddenly not dangerous because I'm not going to die.
Right. It would change how you move through the world.
It's more interesting. It's more interesting because you have to face the consequences of what you do. You don't just die and then go, well, I'm going to roll a new character, done. You have to live with the things that you do, the things that you go through, which I think is much more narratively interesting than just like, I've run out of hit points and I die.
Yeah.
And if you want a more old school version of the Wild Sea, when you filled up all your aspect tracks, you die. It's not a hard rule to add in, really. In fact, it's such an easy rule to add in. I didn't even add it in the core book as a variant rule because it seemed obvious.
Yeah.
But it's the one, like the Wild Sea gets criticized for a few things, and some of them are more legitimate than others, but that's the least legitimate one, I think. Like, narrative death isn't any less threatening than real life death, and it means that you stay in the game that you want to play for as long as you want. Story is king.
It's also the ultimate expression of the claim that I think is rightfully so made, that this is a narrative focused game, because it takes the most extreme version of that and says there is no mechanical way for this to happen. It is only happening through the narrative, which I think is just the ultimate check in the box of, is this a narrative-based game? Yes, sir, it is.
It's just, most stories, they don't have one of their main characters die. They can die unexpectedly, and they can die dramatically, but they rarely die for no reason.
Right.
Because that doesn't really make a good story. It can be good for a shock occasionally, but it just doesn't make a good story, especially when it can happen at any time.
Yeah, and it feels bad sometimes when you're playing and your character dies in a really, you know, dumb way, or like just like the roll of the dice in D&D. I'm thinking mostly D&D. I can think of times where characters have died where it's like really unsatisfying.
It's actually that's where the root of the rule comes from, was the first time I've ever made a sorcerer in 3.5.
And just died right away.
I didn't get to cast a single spell. I got hit with an arrow. It got me down to minuses. I failed my death saving throws. The rest of the team, because we were level one, couldn't even maneuver to me to get me back up again. And I just died. And it was like, okay. And my DM wasn't a bad guy, but he was a bit of a stickler. And he's like, well, you can make a new character. I was like, oh, can I not just be sorcerer number two, his brother? He's like, no, make a new character. It's like, okay. By the time I made a new character, the game was over.
Mm-hmm.
I'd spent 20 minutes playing a game which I'd given a whole evening to. It's like, that's not the experience I want to foster with my own games.
Yeah.
I do also think that by giving the players like complete control over when their character dies, it allows you to play for as long as you want, which is great, but it also gives you that permission and that power to have the surprise death that maybe would be unsatisfying if it happened accidentally, but you can make epic by choosing it, and you can really lean into it. And if you know it's coming, and if you're kind of in your head planning for it, whether or not you're the Firefly or the other players are prepared for it, you can then make that choice to do the one crazy thing of the session.
And I've seen people do it too. I've seen people sacrifice their character or have their character die in a really dramatic way that aids the story, just because they feel like, yeah, this is the right time. I've been knocked around a lot. I'm damaged. I could heal from this stuff. I could get better. I could survive. But narratively speaking, this would be a brilliant point to go out. People are going to remember this one.
Mm.
And they do.
There is a real element to this that even me who's played a lot of indie games and a lot of non-D&D games, is you have to kind of reorient your brain a little bit, because if you've started with D&D or if that's one of your main touch points, there is an element of, we are creating a story, but we also have to correctly play this game. Like the game with like, a capital G, like there are rules. You have to succeed. If you do not succeed, the narrative is decided for you.
Mm.
With a game like this, with a game that has less mechanics around death or around combat, it really is like we're trying to tell a story together. And that is so much more to the forefront that it's a weird thing to say, but you kind of have to reorient your brain of like, this is a storytelling game rather than a you know, combat. Like you're
not playing to win. Yeah.
Yeah. Even more so the idea of like what the classic joke with D&D is like, oh, who won? It's like, oh, it's not really that kind of game. Like this is that times 10.
Right. Yeah. And the thing I said to the crew when we met was like, this is a big book, which might be intimidating when you pick it up at first. But like, crucially, the thing that was clear to me after reading it is like, you don't have to be an expert in the Wild Sea to have a great time playing the Wild Sea.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There is, I saw one of my favorite criticisms, and this is one that I genuinely, I loved, of the Wild Sea, where someone said, like, but you've got 360-something pages, but there's only like 20 pages of dedicated setting. Where's all the rest of the lore? And it's like, well, it's kind of spread throughout the book because you don't want to memorize all that lore.
Right.
You just want to care about the things that matter to your characters. So, like, there's 20 pages of setting. You can skip 19 of those. Like, you can just read the core concepts and then make a character and you are good to go. Like, because that's I think, that makes for an engaging world. There's stuff to dig into. There's fiction bits in the book to delve into. You can read how all the other character stuff works. You can look at the reaches, the pre-made areas, but all of that is skippable if you want to jump straight into the world. I think that's really important, that it's not as intimidating as it might first seem. It really is a game about, like, learn the absolute basics and then just do things that you think are cool for your character. And by learning how to do those things that you think are cool, you've picked up some more stuff about the world. Maybe stuff that no one else in the group will know. And that's your little areas of expertise, because they're about you and the stuff you do and the places you come from.
I do also really love a portion of the layout of this physical book is that, as you said, there's not a lot of lore, but there is a lot of like in-world fiction that's kind of like written on the sides of a lot of the pages.
Yeah, lots of fiction, lots of art.
Lots of fiction, lots of art, and lots of, like, both of them very evocative. And it's very fun to be reading through the book. And, like, you know, every role-playing game book has a bit of a textbook feel to it, no matter how hard you try. But getting to, like, flip a new page and there's a little like, short story kind of on one side, it's like, oh, great, I'm gonna get a little vibe snack. And then I'm going to go back into the hardcore rules. And it actively rewards you for, like, reading more if that's what you're into. If you want to read through the whole book and like really get into all the stuff and take everything in and then choose what you want, you're also rewarded with all these little like fun stories and like little tiny bits of lore, rather than here's the chapter on lore starting with, you know, circa 1950, you know, BV.
I can tell you exactly why I did that.
Why is that?
Because I read Eclipse Phase.
Hmm.
I'm not knocking Eclipse Phase. Fantastic game. I wish the book was laid out a little differently, but fantastic game. Everyone's allowed their own opinions. The thing I loved about Eclipse Phase is it started with a really, really good bit of kind of in-world fiction. I really thoroughly enjoyed that bit of in-world fiction. It really set the scene for me. And then it was a setting chapter. And then it was more of a setting chapter. It was more of a setting chapter. And Eclipse Phase is a game which has some narrative crunch to it. Like, this setting is really important if you want to learn about this world. There's stuff there to learn. That's not a bad thing. That's not doing it wrong. But I found myself missing that early fiction, because there were still things that were written from an in-universe perspective, but they didn't have that weight of, like, I am reading a small story and I'm loving this story. And I felt like I learned a lot more about the world in those few pages of story than I did from the next like 10 or 20 pages of setting, just because it stuck with me. It was evocative. It pulled me into that world. So I wanted to kind of pepper that throughout the Wild Sea book as much as I could. Like, you can read about the different places, or you can just read this little like 100-word story thing at the side. And it's like, oh, I get the vibe of this place. Like, I get that. And then if you still don't get it, look at a picture.
I think I found a similar experience when I was reading through Eusebius' Bed and Breakfast, how like reading through that book is like a scavenger hunt. Like there are things in that book that I've read about online that I realize I haven't read because I haven't like focused enough on certain pages of the book. And this gives me that same feeling of like, I am excited to continue reading it, even if it's like a section that I know I'm not going to use, because there's these little hidden gems that are very fun.
Oh, I had a bit of advice, something I forgot to say earlier.
Yeah, go for it.
again, I'm taking us back like 50 minutes, but it's important. Cut. Don't be afraid to cut. Mm. Cut may feel cruel, but it's not. I've seen a lot of people talk on the Discord because I don't give as clear advice as I should, to be fair, in the book on how often to cut. And that's because for me, it seemed instinctive, but again, I'm not at your table. I should have anticipated it. So my direct advice to you, Elliot.
Yes.
Try to cut between 30 and 50% of the time.
Mm.
You're cruel.
Doesn't have to be a big cut. Cut of one is absolutely fine. But that means that rolled where there is no cut, people will feel safe. Rolled where there's a little bit of cut, people will get used to. They'll know that cut is a thing that happens. Sometimes you're going to lose. Sometimes you're going to lose that little bit of extra, and you're still going to be fine. And then that really shocked me when you felt like, okay, well, this is a three cut. Mm. You're going to lose the top three results. I'm only rolling four dice. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And you can save that for those really rare moments where something absolutely terrible is happening. Or when they're trying to do something that is completely out of left field. So, yeah, cut.
I'll take it.
Don't cut too harshly, but cut reasonably often. There you go. There's my cut advice.
Yeah.
Felix, a thing that Elliot was worried about and that I'm always worried about going into a season, particularly of this show, is that we are limited in that we're doing a relatively short run campaign. Our plan is to do 6 episodes. There are a number of times when we have failed on this show actively when we plan to do 4 or 6 and we end up doing 6 or 8.
I've heard tell of this, yes.
Yes, you have heard tell. Orbital Blues was meant to be 4 episodes. It became 5 and that 5th episode was 3 hours long, so it became 6. Do you have any advice for running mini campaigns like this? And then also like advice for turning something that is shorter into a long running campaign and how you kind of would approach those differently?
For shorter campaigns, don't worry too much about the drives, the characters' drives. The story that the world is telling is more important. For long campaigns or turning a short campaign into a long campaign, bring those drives in. Because a character's drives, if you don't know the system, are just things that they are that literally drive the character. So one character might have, each one has 3. One character might have, like, you know, help out rootless people, seek sand from the Eden Desert, and reach an accord with the wild beast. Like, these are all drives. They very rarely can be worked towards in short time because they tend to call out specific situations which are not common. They are things that they're goals to achieve. They're things you have to work towards. Longer campaigns, follow some drives. Like, let people start working towards completely fulfilling their drives. Shorter campaigns, if they act in a way that helps their drives, brilliant. But it shouldn't be the focus of the minute-to-minute roleplay because you don't have time to explore everyone's drives and everyone's wants and needs. It's better to just tell a kind of good, cohesive story where the world takes center stage for why these things are happening rather than the characters' backstories and things taking center stage.
There's a lot in this game. There's a lot to do. This really I think
sorry.
Honestly, our biggest problem every season is that we pick up a game and we're like, oh, I want to do everything in the game.
Yeah.
And at the end of every single season, during our, like, you know, kind of final cast talkback, what is the common refrain of, oh, we should make a second season. Oh, we should make a campaign of this. Oh, I wish we'd done 10 episodes instead of 4. Like, oh, I had these plans for my character. And I think ultimately that is just the sign of a good game, that I am excited to dig into everything here. And I'm disappointed that I know we can either take a very light sampling platter of everything, or we can, like, get a full steak of 2 or 3 things.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you find that way. I hope you feel that way about Wildsteep once you're playing it. You never know.
I have a feeling we will.
I have a feeling. I've got a sneaking suspicion that we will.
Sneaking suspicion.
We're kind of winding down here towards the end of this episode. But Elliot, I want to circle back with you and check back with those things that you were nervous about over-prepping, about whispers, about making use of the Root and Storm additions. Are there any last minute questions you have? And how do you feel after talk with Felix? Has he been able to assuage all of your worries?
Yeah, I'm feeling good. I'm honestly, there's a couple tidbits in here that are just, like, enough for me to, like, go forth and use, like, I make the ship first, honestly, is making me feel really good about session 0, which I was a little nervous about, but didn't mention. Like, I feel like that'll be a really fun device there. Using tracks like, as the most prep you do is making a few tracks makes a lot of sense to me. That's something that I can, like, limit myself with. And then also love the advice of just, like, grabbing some hazards and monsters and creatures that I think are cool, because that's, like, what I respond to in this book is, like, flipping through and seeing the cool creature art and all that. And yeah, the whispers. Really, really excited about the whispers. Especially that person who was a whisper collector really makes me think, like, I think I might end up being, I might, you know, lean more liberal with whispers than less, but I think it'll be fun.
Whisper collector alchemist is going to really live in my brain in a way that I'm going to want to just steal it. I currently want to just steal it. I might cut it out of the episode so I look like a genius.
I got to spoil that cut now. My favorite thing about that character was that was the first Wild Sea character that player had ever made. It was just for a one shot.
No way. Love that.
It's a brilliant character.
I hate them. I hate them. I hate them and their genius. Oh, I want to make more. I'm going to sit down and make more characters tonight.
Yeah.
Well, someone made a Chelicrate character that was just the luggage from Discworld. just a wooden metal box with tons of spiders inside that moves around on tiny spider legs. Like, it was just the luggage.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm excited.
But no, I think I'm feeling good, Felix. This has been super helpful. Thank you.
Good.
Felix, before we get out of here, any last minute pitfalls or piece of advice you'd want to give to Elliot or anyone else playing the Wild Sea?
Oh, do cool stuff. Say no rarely. But you can say no occasionally. Like, don't just yes and everything. Sometimes you can be like, I don't know if that's going to... You can say no. It's not improvisational theater as much as we'd like to pretend it is sometimes. Like, you can still do GME stuff. But I think the other thing, don't forget to make use of unsetting questions. And don't feel like you can only use them at the start of a session as well. One of the nicest ways to have, especially, again, low prep games, is to, when you reach a new location, you as the GM know a few things that are happening there, you know, the core bits. Don't be afraid to ask characters, like, what rumors they've heard about this place. They may or may not be true. Who knows? But you've now got some seeds that you can use or not as the story kind of dictates. Unsetting questions. Also made by Rick. He made The Steep. He made Unsetting Questions. He's made, like, a half of a percent of this book, but they're the bits that I talk about the most because I love the stuff he makes. So, yeah. Rick, good job, Rick.
Shout out, Rick.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah. And he's our head of playtesting, so he's the one person in the world who's probably played more Wild Sea than me.
Mm. Love it. We'll get him on the show next.
Yeah.
Oh, you should. He's amazing.
Felix, thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you want to let people know where they can find you and your games on the internet if they're looking for you?
Yep, you can find all the digital stuff for the Wild Sea and Storm and Root and the Extra Adventures and the Ship Garden supplement, and it is just growing things on your ship. You can find all that at felixisaacs@itch.io. Well, not at, but you know what I mean. Itch.io, Felix Isaacs, search the Wild Sea on Itch and you'll find it. And if you want things in the more physical realm, you can go to the MythWorks site, myth.works. But you might be out of luck there because we had some stuff happen recently and we got weirdly extra popular. And I thought we were doing fine before that, but now we're doing really fine. And we're going to sell out of books. We may already have sold out of books as we have this conversation, but sorry. But we'll have some more in a few months' time because we're reprinting, so it's all going to be good.
If you haven't already listened to the Quinn's Quest review on YouTube, that is the reason that Wild Sea blew up exponentially overnight, you should definitely check it out because it's a very good video.
Wait, no, I thought it was because we are doing a season of the Wild Sea. No?
Yeah.
It's definitely us.
People heard about you and they were like, that Wild Sea game, now that's hot stuff.
Yeah.
They heard it brewing in the background, not the unannounced thing.
The unannounced, yeah. My first unannounced season thing, really sold you out.
Very good. I'm very excited to start playing this. And that is all for this episode of My First Dungeon. Join us next week when we're going to be meeting our wild sailors and building our ship so we can set sail into the verdant waves. If you want to hear even more My First Dungeon, head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod to get bonus actual plays, cast talkbacks, and a whole lot more. And as always, remember, if you're having fun, you're already doing it right. Bye-bye, everybody.
All right.
Bye.
If you're hearing this, that means you have listened to every last second of this episode, and that probably makes you a fan of this show. Well, if you're a fan and you like what we're doing and want to help others find it as well, then consider leaving us a 5-star review over on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. Getting more ratings really does help more people find the show, and reading your nice words about the things that we put out into the world makes us feel all warm and good inside, and we want more of those good, good feels. So head on over to your podcast player of choice and leave us a 5-star review. Thanks.